In this episode of Chew the Fat, we meet a man who is razor sharp, a man who treats Irish waters as his oyster, and a man with his pincers firmly on the pulse of Dublin, not to mention having his net cast on some of the most prime restaurant locations this city has to offer. Chef, restaurateur, wholesale fishmonger Niall Sabongi, aka the man behind Claw, with a K.
From beginning with Rock Lobster to taking over with his trio of Claw restaurants dominating the seafood game in the Irish capital, Niall is a man with an undying passion for seafood and wants to change the way we all perceive the spoils of the sea. We should respect it and sustain it, but we should also buy it, cook it, and enjoy it much more than we have been doing. So, more than a man with just a taste for the sea, he's a man on a mission.
Coaxing his customers into trying new things whilst also trying to change both the conversation and the landscape as a Fáilte Ireland food champion, Niall is someone who everyone knows. And if you don't know him yet, you really should get to know him.
So we drop by his newest opening, Claw Seafood Cafe on Fane Street in Temple Bar, to get to know the man behind the mackerel, the monkfish and the mussels.
I'm a chef turned restaurateur turned fishmonger based in Dublin. I have three really teeny tiny restaurants is a big word. So I've got two crab shacks and a cafe. So there's Claw, the original, on Crown Alley. Where it's all just about oysters and crab, and it was, you know, kind of the original kind of mission to slap the posh out of seafood and make it accessible and easy and just have some fun with it. And from there it grew into then Claw on Caper Street. So up until now it's been called Claw Poke, but I'm actually realigning all the brands in September, so it's going to be called Claw Caper Street, and kind of bring the offering in line with what the other ones are. So Claw on the north side, it was the kind of give all of our, you know, I suppose the Dubliners, Claw outside of Temple Bar. Temple Bar is a brilliant area, it really is an excellent area, and that's not what we all remember it to be or think it to be. You know, you think it's going to be Larry English, you know, stag dudes and everyone getting sick in the corners, and it's really not. It's really, really very vibrant and, you know, cultural, and there's so much going on in it. It's a brilliant little area. But still, there's, you know, we get a lot of regulars, locals that kind of go to the original. And they just want, you know, they want one outside of where there's a lot of tourists. So that's that little one. That's a year old just last month. So, yeah, 1 year already. And then in my craziness, I said, hey, let's open a third one. And so we opened the cafe, the Seafood Cafe, so where we are now at the moment. And we're a little over 6 months here now. 7 months. Yeah, six, 7 months now. So,
it's absolutely flown by.
It really has gone by. It's been wild, to be honest with you. I suppose kind of upscaling from one to three, and then I still have the wholesale. So Sustainable Seafood Ireland has been going since 2013, and I suppose that's our wholesale side of it. We supply about 30 restaurants in Dublin. It kind of grew organically. The idea was, well, for me, I just wanted better fish and I'd get closer to the source and deal with boats and have more of a direct link and contact with people. And it wasn't possible in Dublin at the time. So 2013, we started, from 20, even before that, probably about 15 years ago, maybe, I started buying bits and pieces for myself, and it kind of became more and more and more and more. And then 2013, we limited the company and went solely. So I've been kind of buying, solely supplying myself, but with that came the need to supply other people because you need to buy more, buy bulk. So a couple of friends, you know, from juniors or, you know, CBH or, you know, Bastable, those kind of guys, friends kind of started to buy bits of fish off us, and it kind of grew organically from there. It's been a hectic short while.
Life just before that. Tell us about what it was all about.
Before Claw, there was Rock Lobster, which I owned for a few years, which is great. It was in Donnybrook originally, and it was all about, again, big seafood accessible. And at the time, lobster was quite cheap. The big Asian market wasn't there, so you could import lobsters quite cheap from the States and from Canada. So the model was built on that. And it did really well when it was in Donnybrook. So we then moved it to Harvey Nichols. So Harvey Nichols contacted us and Dundrum, and like, oh, you know, come out here, blah, blah, blah. We're like, oh, Harvey Nichols, you know, so flashy and blah, blah, blah. We thought it was a great idea. It wasn't. It was a terrible idea. It turned out kind of, you know, it was more advantage to their brand than it was to our brand. It made us kind of seem expensive and elitist and made them seem accessible and open. So it didn't work out great for us. But we, you know, we gave it a go. But kind of during that kind of period, it was 200 seats and a big cocktail bar, and I got to cook rarely. I got to hang out on the floor rarely. It was just, you know, it was just so many moving parts, and it was kind of getting away from what Rock Lobster was and ultimately what I am as a person and a chef. And then Tampa Bar came up, Claw came up, and I was like, this I can do, you know, very few seats, and, you know, get to cook and hang out. And
the original Claw is on Crown Alley, right? Had you chosen the area first, or had you chosen the space, or how did you?
It all kind of came up. I was in the area with some friends. We went to get chowder and oysters. Couldn't find anywhere to get a chowder or oysters, and then we did. I think it was like 14 quid for a chowder. It was really, really bad, and some terrible oysters. So I was like, wow, there's something missing a link here. And then an architect friend of mine then came a couple months later and said, oh, there's this tiny little premises. Do you want to have a look at it? And, you know, he told me the square footage of it. I was there kind of going, like, nothing's going to fit in there. And then he came back to me about a month later. He goes, you really should probably have a look at this. So I went and had a look at it, and kind of anytime I take somewhere, I kind of lock myself in it for a few hours. So I sat there with a coffee for like 5 or 6 hours and sat outside for the evening and just kind of watched it kind of going around, and then went, yeah, we can do something here. So I started designing it and opened it in 10 days.
Logistically speaking, you really have to think on your feet in a lot of ways with the original premises, because I remember the first time we went in there, actually it wasn't too long after you were open. Everyone working there was like, you have to try the chowder. I was like, okay, we'll try the chowder. Absolutely. And then you just see a flamethrower in the corner of the restaurant going off.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, so a lot of it was kind of like people, you know, it wasn't done. So we used to serve it in tin cans and with a blowtorch, because the only way we could get the heat into it fast enough to warm up the chowder was to put it in something we could conduct it and serve it in the same vessel and a blowtorch. We just have a flat top there, so trying to get the heat into it was impossible. And I didn't want to go for this whole, the typical thing, you know, we're used to seeing with chowder, with this kind of soup sitting there for hours, bubbling away in a cauldron type thing, with all the fish overcooked. So all the fish cooked to order in it. So we need to get the heat into it quickly. So that was kind of born out of necessity. But same as the blowtorch oysters, we're too small to have a salamander or a grill. I was like, well, I want to do a cooked oyster. So again, it's like, I know, we'll use a blowtorch, a big feck off, you know, industrial welding blowtorch. And yeah, so the blowtorch was born.
And it has become so iconic, I suppose, for any of your premises. Yeah. Like, I think even if I'm not in the mood for an oyster, and I'm nearby, I have to come in and go because it's so dramatic looking and it's so unique. But it's almost a signature in a way for you.
It is. I mean, there's not many things, but I suppose there are, actually, can't we say that, signature things that we do, but I suppose there's a few dishes that we do that have just become kind of synonymous with Claw. And wielding a blowtorch is definitely one of them. And the guys love it. Like, I mean, if you ever see Jamie, our area manager, you know, give that guy a blowtorch and, you know, he'll make something to eat out of it. Like, he literally goes to it rather than doing anything else. He literally goes to the torch straight away. Like, but yeah, they're fun to use, and yeah. It tastes great as well, though.
Oh, yeah.
So it does. I mean, you get that, like, especially with the oyster, because you get the caramelized, crispy, smoky top, and then it's cool and cold in the bottom. So you get that whole textural thing, and then the whole temperature changes as well. So, yeah, I like.
So this might be the million-dollar question that we're asking very early on, but why are we so awful with seafood in this country, or what needs to change?
Well, it's a generational thing. It's something that's transpired over years and years. You can go back, you know, as far as the famine, and you can look at, you know, Cromwell had a policy, you weren't allowed to own land within 10 miles of the coast, because they could obviously see the wealth of the water while they were all fishing all the salmon out of the Irish waters and shipping it back, and we weren't eating it, you know. So the separation began, you know, even then. And then, you know, when the actual famine came on and the brain drain, and obviously all of our fish and food was taken in taxes, and we're just left with, you know, obviously the rotting potatoes, etc. You know, and then with that, there was obviously a huge brain drain in Ireland. Everyone left. People on the coast kind of left first. They had boats, or they had an access to get out of, or they had a skill, and, you know, they got off the island. And with that then, the kind of the heritage and the knowledge of it, you know, like, so even like the likes of, I'll bring up the example, obviously you see all the salt cod hanging there, but we used to do salt ling, and it's called a washboard, because, you know, it looks like a washboard almost, you know, it's hard and stiff. We used to do the washboard in Ireland, and, you know, it was a fantastic dish. It was, you know, rehydrated and delicious. But I suppose with the brain drain, and then Catholicism jumped in and said, you have to eat, you know, it's penance, you know, punishment, like, you have to eat fish on a Friday. People have to eat fish, so, but we didn't have the knowledge how to cook fish, or, you know, the product even to do it. So you have the likes of, you know, the salt cod or the salt ling being shipped from, say, I've used this before, but from, you know, from kind of Cork to Leitrim. You know, by the time we got there, the lashings of rain in November, all piled up, it would be all soaking wet, it'd be gone off by that stage. And then people would try and cook it at home. That's why you get this horrible pong of fish. And even now to today, you know, this is a learned habit. This whole, you know, smelling of fish, you know, where we a lot of people in Ireland will rinse their noses compared to on the continent, or even my own kids, you know, if they smell fish, you know, they lift their heads to embrace it, you know, so it's a learned habit. So I suppose they're kind of, there's some of the reasons, there are definitely some of the reasons, but, you know, I suppose it's the recession in the 80s when obviously fish was very expensive, and everyone in Europe is willing to pay more for fish than Irish people are generally. They appreciate it more. They, you know, they definitely still remember it's a wild product. So these aren't, it's not like, you know, there's a little John Dory sitting out there just waiting to be caught. Like, these animals move around all the time. It's a real skill and a real danger for people to go out fishing for them in tiny little vessels. And like, the Irish Sea is massive. You know, on the other side, on the west coast, the seas are massive. Like, you know, you might look at it today, you know, it's balmy and sunny and lovely. You go out there, you're talking like 40, 50 foot waves. You're talking colossal. You know, it's big, big stuff. Like, so, to cost is obviously, has been, a thing as well. But I know, like, ultimately, I think it's part of our DNA. Back to the first settlers in Ireland, that's what we ate. You know, we're a coastal people, coastal communities. And there is a shift. You can see it. I mean, people, you know, sure, I've got 3 crab shacks.
Is cheap fish a thing?
Cheap fish? Well, there's affordable fish. I won't say cheap fish. I mean, cheap fish would generally be associated with kind of bad fish, or, you know, intensively farmed fish, or unethically farmed, or unethically fished, or unsustainable. Would generally be cheaper, but obviously terrible for the environment and for the people and for everything. Is there more affordable fish? Yeah, absolutely. There's hundreds and hundreds of species that we don't utilize. Like, even the likes of, you know, like, we have coelie in the menu all the time, and I know Boxy House now use it a lot as well, and Pete and the fish shop use it as well. It's a fantastic, fantastic, delicious coelie's pollock. It's black pollock. It's called salty in Norway, and they have a big season for it, and it's, you know, they're so precious over it. Whereas here, we just think of it as just, you know, this bycatch or discarded fish, and I mean, it is stunning. And yeah, it's, you know, it's half the price of cod. So, you know, I think, I don't know what you'd pay in a, I've no idea what you'd pay in a fishmonger for a cod off a slab, maybe 14, 15, 16 euros. You'd probably pay 6, 7, 8 for coelie. And it's, you know, it's better in tasting wine. It's not as bone, it's not as pure white as cod, but, like, it doesn't have to be pure white. That's some, you know, that's a something we've taken from bird's eye ads, thinking that all fish is white underneath the crumb, like, you know, and it shouldn't be. There should be all different textures and colours, like lamb or beef or chicken or anything else. Going to a fishmonger is what's important, I think, now, you know, and, you know, that industry is kind of falling away, because you go to supermarkets and you see a piece of salmon for £2, like, no fishmonger in his right mind can sell that for £2. Just cannot be done. Yeah. But big supermarkets are doing it because, you know, well, A, it's not Irish, or it's farmed intensively, or they're just using it as a loss leader, and it's kind of killing the kind of the other small high street stores. So in time, I guarantee you, the fishmonger will be reinvented and look more like what we're seeing in kind of artisan butcher shops around now, and all reinvented.
How quickly is that happening?
That's happening now. So we're the first stages of their monger are well underway, and hopefully by the end of summer we'll give you a address for the first urban monger. So the whole thing with urban monger was, originally it was going to be on Georgia Street, and it was 3 stories over basement, still a camera shop. But at the time, I kind of went, just because you can expand, it doesn't necessarily mean you should expand. So I said, you know what, actually in 2018 I'm not going to do anything else, just focus on the four businesses and really make them good and, you know, just great, so they can be here forever, institution almost. So I pulled out of George Street, and then when I did, kind of more and more people I spoke to kind of went, oh, I'd love a fishmonger beside me like that. And I, you know, so the idea is I'm going to basically flip it around and make it more interactive and kind of blend it with what Claw is and what a fishmonger is and what I think a fishmonger is, and kind of make it a more, much more experiential led and just really change, redefine it completely for the market. It's not a model I've seen anywhere, it's just kind of like how I would like to shop if I was shopping for fish. So the more people I spoke to, they kind of said, oh, I love that in my area, I love that in my area. And there are very few fishmongers around. Now that may be, you know, I may, you know, maybe telling me something, but I don't think so. I think that if it's successful in the first kind of one, I would like to see it roll out across Dublin and indeed Ireland. So maybe we might see three or four of them in 2019, and then maybe more then in 2020, and kind of really, really, really push it out there. The first one will be on the north side. That's all the info I'm going to give you right now. There'll be loads of things. I mean, you can go in like in the evening and do a skillery and, you know, learn about fish, or you can do a little cookery class, or, you know, you can buy other products in there as well. And, you know, it'll be very, very immersive. But without it being posh and, you know, pretentious and stuff, which it often is, you know. So it would take the same approach to Claw and everything else took. You know, it is what it is. It's seafood, we're an island, and this is just how you hopefully do it justice.
If you could have everyone in Ireland in a classroom and you could tell them two or three things about how to choose fish, how to prepare fish, how to eat fish, what would they be?
How to buy fish, buy from a fishmonger. Simple as. You know where it's caught, you know when it was caught, you can see the freshness of it. You can talk to them, you know, it's a real jobs and it's, you know, it's a real industry. So that would be that'd be 100%. If you talk to a fishmonger, they'll never steer you wrong, and they know fish, like they know it. When choosing a fishmonger, generally they never smell a fish. They smell the ocean, they smell briny, and that's what you're looking for in a fishmonger. That and a bit of crack. Fishmongers are generally a bit of crack. So that'd be buying it, cooking. Keeping it simple and not being afraid of it. Like don't be afraid of it. You know, if you get it, you know, take a whole brill or a whole little turbot and you can pop that in the oven and roast it off with potatoes, you know, and, you know, a little bit of butter and some seasoning, and just roast the whole thing in the oven and have a really good Sunday roast with it, you know. And it's as simple as that. You're not going to go far wrong with it. When cooking fillets, I suppose to me, I'd rather fill a pan roasted. I only cook it on one side. Hot pan, but not smoking hot. You're not cooking a steak. Oil the pan, not the fish. Season the fish, not the pan. Undercook it every time. Use butter liberally. But I suppose just try different things. I mean, mussels are a great thing to cook at home. Super simple, big pot of mussels. You know, and you're trying to get your kids and stuff to eat seafood. Like my eldest son, Callum, you know, loves seafood. He'll literally eat, well, he eats literally everything off the beach. He'll go and pick, you know, limpets off the rocks, eat them raw on the beach, or I'll bring them home and insist that we make a pasta out of them. Whereas my youngest son, Max, wouldn't be as keen, so I had to go through the whole thing of, you know, getting really nice fillets of fish and, you know, buying that really terrible, cheap yellow breadcrumbs, not even panko, the orange stuff, and making it look like a ridiculous fish finger. And then he loved it. Or, you know, or giving him mussels, you know, he gets to eat with his hands and get messy. Or give him a crab, you know, crab claws and a hammer. Like, give any child his dinner with a hammer, like they're going to give it a go. So stuff like that's really easy to do, really, really easy to do at home, and it's fun, and it's messy, and, you know, it's a super simple way of getting into it. Might even do some recipes this year.
Have you thought of a book?
I've been giving a little bit of thought lately, because I email a lot of recipes to people kind of daily, people looking for different recipes, how to use different fish. So yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah, it's something I've been going to kind of toy with the idea. I've no real idea how to approach it or anything like that. I've thousands, millions of recipes. Every one of the restaurants has its, you know, a recipe card. So I'm hoping that I can take a photograph and just photocopy them. That'd be a big bit of bang.
I guess everybody associates you with fish, but also that goes hand in hand with chips. So where in town is the best place for chips?
And you can't say any of your own properties. A guilty pleasure place.
Place in town for chips. Where does really good chips? Well, Fish Shop do a mean ass chip. I'm not a big chip eater. I won't lie to you.
This interview is terminated.
That's it. Yeah, no, I'm not a huge chip eater. Yeah, like my missus, she'll generally love a bag of blocks. Delito chipper, they do really good. Or actually, if I'm going to go get fish and chips somewhere that's not the seafood cafe, I'm fine with Dylan too, I would go to the Kingfisher down near the Rotunda.
Yes.
They do sandwich. Their chips are great and their fish is immaculate. Mm. It's perfect and it's great selection of it and stuff. They're cool. They're cool. I like them.
We're feeling a little bit shook that he isn't really into chips. But anyway, we are interrupting this broadcast for a quick moment as we want to say a huge thank you for tuning into this episode of Chew the Fat. We hope you know the story by now. If you are enjoying what we're doing and like to support us, you can pledge your patronage at patreon.com/gastrogaze. That's patreon.com/gastrogaze, where you will receive some exclusive content such as episodes before anyone else and some really exclusive things direct from us to you, loyal listener.
If you're not interested in a monthly thing but still want to show your support for our 100% free weekly production, you can do a one-time donation via PayPal for as large or as little as you like. That's paypal.me/gastrogaze. And if you want to keep in touch with us online, you will find lots more from us on gastrogaze.com, and we're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook as @gastrogaze.
Be sure to follow us there as well. Back though to Niall and Claw Seafood Cafe. He mentioned earlier on about the wholesale arm of the business, and we want to know a little bit more about that, other ventures and concepts up his sleeve at the moment.
We have a waiting list. It's about 8 months at the moment. But the idea of SSI though, like, I don't want to be a big massive supply 300 restaurants in Dublin. It's about being really, really good. And if you get it to a certain size, I've got a friend, Mac, who unfortunately, his boat got into troubled waters, we'll call it, and he's dying to get back out fishing. So if I think that we can support a boat out fishing, as in take all the fish off them, that would be great. So Mac will go out fishing for us and we can then use that, which means we'll get those bycatch and little fish and weird fish and all the rest of it and kind of change it like that. But we're building a new wholesale at the moment, and the brief is going to be like the Google of fish, basically. Ultra environmentally friendly. We're trying to just do some old things. So we'll do loads of smoking, do loads of salting, and kind of change it. But that will kind of link in with the urban monger then as well, and doing kind of dishes and preparing kind of dishes that you can kind of buy in the shop and bring home and cook at home, and kind of in a kind of a step format that I'm kind of working on to try and take a bit of the fear away from kind of, you know, so you can go get some red mullet or some brill or, you know, a ray wing and go home and kind of have instructions on how to do it in a simple kind of hopefully tasty manner.
Is there any fish that you just don't like?
No, not yet. The only thing I don't like is snails. As in, I like sea snails, but land snails, they're the only things I don't like. Them and baked beans, wouldn't be mad about them. But other than that, like, there's literally nothing I won't eat. I love, and my kids are the same. Like, yeah, like, we're brought up and we're very, very lucky, like, dragged up in the restaurant business in Dublin, so we ate everything from young ages. Snails just annoy me. Like, I'll still order them. I'm going to Greece next week. I guarantee I'll order them at least twice and hate them. It just annoys me. Frog's legs as well. Not crazy about them. Yeah, chicken that tastes like fish, or fish that tastes like chicken. No. There's nothing. There's no. Certainly not any fish. But I think is it anything even in a fish world. No, really not.
There is an item on your menu that, as you're saying, you grew up in restaurants and in food. Tell us about. It's called When I Was.
When I Was Six.
Yes.
So they're just our grilled prawns. I suppose the name is because it's linked to childhood memory. They remind me of being a kid and kind of grilling prawns at home. We do nothing to it. Everyone kind of asks for the recipe. Like, it's probably the most requested recipe that we have. And it's rapeseed oil from Jack and Newgrange and Achill Island sea salt. Ta-da! That's it. Just roasted over the coals. Andy Noonan from the Big Grill helps us get our charcoal so that it tastes delicious. And other than that, that's really it. Like, there's nothing to it. Like, it's, you know, and it's just so simple and it can be done at home so easily. Just be really liberal with your salt. a little dash of your rib tooth oil just so they don't stick terribly to grill for you, and just char grill them, like, and that's it. Like, it's just, it's the easiest thing in the world. Like, but that's the great thing about fish. You know, you don't need to do anything to it. Like, it's all done for you. It's all taken care of. So yeah,
it is a great ingredient to cook with at the end of the day, mm-hmm. because it's so simple. Yeah. It's so easy to impart so much flavor without doing very much. And it's
very much good. And you know, and it's obviously it's really really healthy. Yeah, and it's delicious. And you know, and it's a national resource that we have, and we should really be proud of it and enjoy it. You know, because the rest of the world, the rest of Europe, certainly enjoy our fish more than we do. Due to quotas and other things, but we'll stay away from that one.
Who is the Claw customer, and has it changed over the years?
I suppose each Claw has kind of its regulars, and then like there's Claw people, you know, people that just, you know, that dig Claw, and they kind of go into all of them, and they go to them for different reasons, or depending on the mood and stuff. It's really varied. It's so varied from, you know, from kids, literally children that want their ask their parents to go in, because they've been in before and they've had prawns and they want them again, to students, to you know, it's such a varied, like Tampa Bar on Crown Alley, it's, you know, it's obviously more tourists, so it's about I'd say 60-40, whereas Caper Street's probably only 10% tourists, and the rest of it's locals, a lot of locals. And then the cafe, then I suppose we're still trying to find, or you know, we're, people are still discovering us. We're only here like 6 months, so but again, it's mad. Like, we're only one street over from the original Claw. I'm the laziest restaurateur in the world. I'm not moving that far away. But it's amazing. Like, it's probably, you know, almost the opposite of, you know, the ratio that Claw will be. So there's a lot more kind of Irish and locals that kind of eat here. But it is a little bit bigger, and seats and, yeah, with seats and toilets and stuff. Very posh.
How had you the inspiration to open up Claw?
Loads of people asked me this, you know, like, oh, what gave you the idea? Oh, it's brilliant, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But, like, there was no, you know, epiphany or, you know, any moment. It was a gap in the market. It was something that I'm passionate about. I love eating seafood, and I hate generally eating seafood in Ireland because it's not great, and or else it's really, really posh and stuff, and I just wanted something easy. And when I go to the States, or if I go to south of France, or if I go to Spain, or I go to Portugal, I travel a lot, clearly, or I go anywhere, it's accessible, and it's easy, and it's fun, and it's delicious, and I just wanted a bit of that.
And you well and truly did bring it to Dublin. And that leads me quite nicely on to another little project you're doing with Vulture Ireland, the Food Champion, yep. as well, which is a really great initiative where people like yourself, who are very much involved and at the heart of different food scenes around the country, are coming together basically to bring the ideas forward. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your involvement?
So one of the Vulture Ireland Food Champions, like, it was such a great honour to be asked. I was kind of like, oh, really? And the guys that are involved, and all the other champs are just, you know, they're just brilliant. And like we said, I mean, I've made friends from these group of people that I will be friends with forever, because we're all just so ridiculously passionate about what we do, or about food in general, or about the culture of food and about the industry. Like, even Olivia Duff, do you know Olivia? Yeah. Olivia, she gave me some of Charlotte, one of her pigs, a nice big ham to bring home. And so I was ringing her and kind of sending her messages and photographs of me cooking the ham, and then eating the ham, and then having a snack later, and then making the sandwiches the next day. And I was just so fucking excited. And then she kind of rang me, you know, like, I'm so lazy, I never type, so we always leave voice messages. And all I got was, I love that you're so excited as I am. Nobody else fucking gets it. It's great. And that's kind of it. That's kind of the Food Champs in a nutshell. We're all really, really excitable when it comes to food. And I suppose, if you look at Chris up in Donegal, and, you know, or Tom down in Limerick, and, you know, all these food champs around, you know, they're doing so many great things. And, you know, it's not paid, there's nothing in it, but it's 100% for the greater good. And we get to hang out, and we get to talk about food, and hopefully we can get to kind of link in with other people and, you know, change the perception of food. Like, so that's one of the kind of big things, kind of, I suppose, come out of it, was, you know, the This Is Irish Food, with Seanine, down at Mullen Grocers, and Anthony, and that, is This Is Irish Food, and changing the perception, you know, in the world. Because, like, I guarantee, like, I mean, 9 times out of 10, people come in, like, we talk to them in Clare, one of the restaurants, and they're like, wow, I didn't expect the food to be like this at all. I thought it was going to be bacon, cabbage, and potatoes. Now, like, I love bacon, cabbage, and potatoes. I had it twice last week with Olivia's ham, like, for Christ's sake. It's delicious, but there's so much more to it. And I suppose we're just trying to change the perception of it, that it's not just that. There's so many great producers. And I suppose we start talking to chefs, you look at what JP's done down the West. And JP was the first set of Food Champions. And that's how the whole Food on the Edge kind of started off, what was from it. So amazing things have come from it. But chefs, when they get here, you know, are like, they can't believe, people can't believe how close we are to everything. How close we are to the farmer, how close we are to the animals, how close we are to the fishermen, how close we are to all the produce, you know, to cheese makers and stuff. You don't have that in the rest of the world. We literally just don't realise it, you know. Literally, you know, I buy my oil off Jack in Newgrange, and I know Jack well. I've been for beers with him, you know. You go to anywhere in Italy, and the likelihood of them knowing the guy they're buying the olive oil off is, you know, fairly slim. Or the cheesemakers, you know, if you, you know, look at Gabriel down there in Ireland, and we use his goat cheese, or, you know, there's just, yeah, it's amazing what we have here. So it's quite easy to get passionate about it. The credit has to go to Foggia, Ireland, like how they picked such a motley crew of lunatics, and we were able to put them together. It's just brilliant. Yeah, very, very privileged.
It just works, though.
Huh? It does. It's been brilliant. It's been brilliant. Yeah, I can't believe it's 3 years now.
It's wow. Champ, yeah. That long?
Yeah, it's the 3rd year, yeah.
It's flown by.
I know, it really has. So it's only for 3 years. So we're put out to pasture next year. But yeah, but it's been amazing. As I said, I mean, we've made friends that, you know, are literally there for forever. Like, you know, yeah. It's awesome. Awesome.
You have, in fairness, you have done a really great job in this whole This Is Irish Food movement. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, yeah, and it's like so important.
Movement, like when you use the word movement, like meaning, and hopefully will, you know, and hopefully it will inspire other, you know, because while we live in Dublin, you know, or you know, if you're in a major city, it's different, but you know, and unfortunately the Midlands and other places and smaller towns don't get the same kind of trade that we get and the same kind of growth of industry and things like that. So hopefully this can kind of help bridge that and bring it all together into the Midlands and the, you know, customer experiences and tourist experiences and that kind of thing. So hopefully it will change. We'll just keep on, you know, keeping it honest like it is, letting it develop and letting it grow and letting our industry grow. And you know, we should, you know, we are a foodie destination, you know. We you know,
I have a burning question. Fish and cheese, is it ever able to work?
Love it. Love it. Love a fish and cheese together. I love fish and cheese. It's very Italian, you know. The old mental. I remember working in an Italian restaurant. We used to own an Italian restaurant called Romanzo years ago, and it was all Italian chefs in the kitchen, and they would go fucking berserk. Yeah. If someone goes, can I have the parmesan? I say,
for what?
You know what I mean? For what? What dish exactly? But no, I think it's lovely. I mean, one of my kind of guilty pleasures is I just probably shouldn't have phrased it that way, but one of my guilty pleasures is probably like a sea bass or something like that, or a bream, with like a Greek salad, like with loads and loads of feta cheese, and the saltiness and the texture of it just going with the fish is just delicious. We have a lovely mackerel salad on tomorrow, I think. The menu changing tomorrow, and that's with loads and loads of cheese. It's delicious. No, absolutely not. Cheese and fish is delicious. We're doing like a new toasted sandwich, like butter on the outside, toast on the flat top with loads of cheese and crab at the moment over in Claw. Cheese and fish, yeah. Creaminess of it and the texture and stuff. It's just delicious. Like anchovies and cheese, delicious, you know. So, yeah, no.
Okay, that's that question answered. Niall is clearly a force on the Dublin scene, and if you're visiting this fair city, be sure to stop by at least one of Niall's restaurants, which are handily all within walking distance of one another, because you will find some of the best examples of freshly cooked seafood in the entire city.
Get a torched oyster, believe us, it's amazing. Keep an eye out for what's coming next though, especially Urban Munger, which we're excited to see become a reality in Dublin and beyond over the next year. As an island nation, it really is a travesty that we don't eat more seafood, but Niall's work will never be in vain. We'll get there, and he is one to watch as someone who is truly leading the movement, which is on the cusp of a wave.